യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാദ്വിവരണസ്യ ച. So I must begin by saying that, you know, we are coming to the end of this text. The text has got four chapters. The one that deals with the practices, then the results, and then concentration, which is called samadhi, and liberation. These are the four chapters. Altogether, 195 aphorisms divided into four chapters, each dealing with its own independent topics, altogether constituting a very wonderful analysis of the human mind in its pursuit of higher spiritual enlightenment. This is what the text is all about. Now, after next week, I mean 20, the next class will be today's, 21st, I think. Yeah. So after that, there will be no classes for every month. The following class will be on February the 1st. And we are expecting, as far as possible, to shift these classes to the old temple. That's a plan, because that the classes used to be held in the old temple. There will be no parking problem, as far as we understand. So that's not a problem. So maybe in February the 1st, Friday, we may begin the classes in the old temple, the newly renovated auditorium, which is, as many of you know, the first and oldest Hindu temple outside Asian continent. First Hindu temple, not only in the United States, but outside Asian continent. And it is a sacred place because it was associated with one of the direct disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. I shall just give an idea, an outline of its sanctity. In India, any place, any temple associated with one of the direct disciples of Sri Ramakrishna is considered to be very sacred. So if you go to Benares, if you go to many of the old mutts in India, if there is a room where one of the direct disciples of Sri Ramakrishna lived, one of the brother disciples of Vivekananda lived, that room will be sacred, considered to be sacred. People will go and meditate. No, just as from here people go to Ramanasrama to meditate in Ramana Maharshi's room. Like that, from all over the world, from India, European countries, from the US, from everywhere, they go and meditate in that room. And it is not always kept open. So it is so sacred, so rare. Here we have a temple that was built by one of the direct disciples. And this temple, it was dedicated 32 years before the Ramakrishna Mission Temple of Headquarters. It was dedicated 1937-38, but this 1905, the construction was completed. 1906, January 7th, it was dedicated. So it is so unique, so ancient, so sacred, and is considered to be one of the sacred places of San Francisco, California. So we will be shifting the classes to that new auditorium, which is associated with the presence of one of the great saints of modern times for 13 years nearly, or more. So that is one information, but that will be only on February the 1st. And we will begin another subject. What I have in mind is Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is a very unique text. It contains all that Yoga Sutras contain, and much more. Yoga Sutras deal with the psychology of human mind. And to that extent, it is helpful for spiritual life, because you know, essentially you cannot differentiate, or you cannot really differentiate mind and spirit. So when you take the spiritual life, you have to begin somewhere at the mental level. We are confronting our own mind, our doubts, anxieties, conflicts. These are what we deal with. When you try to meditate, closing your eyes, sitting in a lonely place, immediately thoughts will emerge in the mind. When you pray, then also you are praying with your mind. When you do some sacred prayers, chanting prayers, then also you are playing with the mind. So mind should become non-mind. Mind should transcend itself, going beyond itself. That's where we reach the highest spiritual level, what we may call mystical level. So mind is the vehicle, is the road through which we travel much of the distance in our spiritual journey. So that's why Yoga Sutras are also very, very important. And the analysis of human mind, its thoughts, impressions, tendencies, why we behave the way we behave, why we act the way we act, why we speak the way we speak. You may call it habits, but why these habits should influence you? Why what you did yesterday should influence our thoughts today? Why what we did perhaps several life cycles earlier should determine the way we live and react with the world today? So all these are found in the Yoga Sutra analysis. But at the higher level, what we are, what's the meaning of human life, human existence, what are the values that guide our life as a whole? What's the real relevance and livableness, meaningfulness of life and existence? Where do we take off once we have solved all the problems of the empirical life? Money, wealth, status, job, everything. Then is there something beyond that? Is there something beyond the credit book, credit card? Something beyond the credit card, beyond the bank balance, beyond success, beyond material prosperity? There you find the questions are answered in the Bhagavad Gita. So it's one of the unique classics that influenced not only Hindus, rather most of the great Buddhist scholars, a good number of Christian scholars, Christian theologians, they've all read Bhagavad Gita. And all the great Indian mystics, Chinese, Buddhists, the Japanese mystics, have, a good number of them have discussed the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. Not only saints, but the great politician saint, or saint politician, whichever we may call him, Gandhi, he had a copy of Gita in his hand. That's what enabled him to lead a whole nation in its struggle for independence in the 20th century. He was a politician. He was a barrister. He had a degree from Inner Temple. And this man, a highly educated man, was carrying this copy of Bhagavad Gita in his hands. And he says that book guided him as his mother. So Gandhi, his mother was Bhagavad Gita. That's an interesting thing. The Gita is a name, it's a feminine gender name, you know. That is his mother actually in his life, Gandhi. And when he was leading the masses against the British, driving them crazy, you know. If you read Gandhi's struggles, very often the British people went crazy, really speaking, including their prince, George V. If Gandhi went to round table conference, London, winter, mind you, wearing only this cotton clad thing, not even a shirt, a cotton, a thin cotton, something he wore. And so he it seemed that they said, the chief of the ceremonies asked him, Gandhi, do you think you have attired to meet His Majesty? Gandhi said, His Majesty has attired for both of us. The king was overdressed with all the paraphernalia. Gandhi was underdressed. So if you put together and divide by two, it's all the same. That's what Gandhi said. And he could do that because he had this copy of Bhagavad Gita in his hand. That's what. So the reason why I'm quoting Gandhi is it is not a book meant for mystics and monks or nuns or those who turn away or move away from social obligations. It is a book that anyone living in the world, whether he believes in God or not, whether he believes in religion or not, if you want to live a meaningful, relevant, livable life, the Gita can be, Bhagavad Gita can be your guide. And it doesn't reject anyone. If you read the Bhagavad Gita, you can accept all traditions, all religions, you can worship and pray to all gods and goddesses, and also you can be spiritual without praying to any god. That's also Gita says. You can be spiritual, you need not go to a temple or a church. That's the Gita's uniqueness. So we will start that class in the old temple. We will announce in the website, and we'll also try to make all our friends informed about this. That is February the 1st. So today and tomorrow, today and next Friday, I will have some sort of what you may call recapitulation of what we have been discussing so far. So this is all about, this is the penultimate class. We have another class next Friday. So as I want to mention earlier, again, the text has 195 aphorisms. Aphorism means a small statement which contains a lot of meaning and significance which needs to be explained and expounded elaborately to make sense of. So this is called aphorisms. So in the printed book you find there are 4 chapters. The chapter dealing with concentration, the chapter dealing with practices, the chapter dealing with powers, the results of yoga, and the chapter dealing with liberation. Now, in real life experience, you begin with practices. Then you think about the results of those practices. The third stage, you attain the ability to concentrate, samadhipada. And the fourth stage, you get liberation. These are the 4 chapters. So we have been discussing along this line. First, sadhana pada, it's a technical name called practices. So if you look at that text, if you have got the book with you, you will see the first sutra of sadhana pada. In your printed book, it could be the second chapter, is Kriya Yoga. Now remember, this Kriya Yoga is totally different, or it has nothing at all to do with what goes by the name Kriya Yoga in popular imagination these days. This is totally different. Kriya Yoga actually here is a combination of Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, and Nishkama Karma. What it means, do your work, your duty, your everyday responsibilities, without any selfish motive. It produces its results, but we need not be enslaved by our greed, by our attachment to the results. Now what happens? You get the result, but even if your results are not up to the expectation, you have absolutely no disappointment. So it is actually 100% win-win situation. You get all the results, and if, suppose, very often, you don't always succeed 100% in every undertaking that you undertake. There is always some chance, possibility, that you may not always succeed 100% in all the endeavors. When it happens, you are not disappointed. This is Karma Yoga. And then Bhakti Yoga is another aspect of this Kriya Yoga. Bhakti means, well, for all those who are brought up with faith in God, going to temples or churches, it's easy for you to think of God, but it should be a God who is the God of the whole creation, not your God alone, that's all. It should be a God who is accessible and who looks upon the whole humanity as his. And not only those who follow him or accept him, he should be compassionate even towards those who may follow him but taking a different route, approaching him from a different angle. So that is bhakti yoga. So that makes you a very noble, broad-minded person, unselfishness in our everyday activities. With a mother looking after children, teachers teaching the student, apart from the salary in the case of a teacher, or the natural affection in the case of a mother, whatever it is, we must do with all concentration, but with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, but without any deep enslaving infatuation or liking for anything. So that is called Kriya Yoga. So the sutra is tapa swadhyaya ishara pranidhanani Kriya Yoga. So three elements are mentioned here: self-control, self-restraint. So when you become free from selfishness or selfish motive, mind gets self-restrained. And then, along with that, one can read, one can practice reading scriptures, chanting sacred words, can also pray, looking upon everything, life as a whole, with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, underlines the basic foundational principle of Kriya Yoga. So that is a very unique thing here. Remember, Patanjali doesn't talk about God here. I don't mean to say that not talking about God is a great thing, not at all. But I mean to say the universality. So anyone can be a practitioner of karma, Kriya Yoga. Any good person who wants peace of mind and also who would not like to disturb other people's peace of mind. Such persons can practice Kriya Yoga, swadhyaya, studying, reading good books, scriptures, need not be study alone, listening to ideas, interacting with people from whom you get only creative, constructive ideas, not destructive ideas, ideas that will not disturb the equilibrium or the peace of the mind, and a sense of surrender. That's again related to those who believe in a monotheistic religion. Ishvara pranidhanani, self-surrender. This is Kriya Yoga. Now what really happens is, when you practice this Kriya Yoga, you develop a kind of intuitive power. That's be discussed in the other coming lectures. When you practice Kriya Yoga, when you practice unselfishness, when we practice a kind of even-mindedness, equilibrium of the mind, no reaction, no interaction with others, then what happens? Mind becomes serene, equal to chitta prasada. So that is the natural calmness of mind. So in this practice, there can be some obstructions. That's a discussion, the third sutra. I'm not going through every sutra. Just generally mentioning the essence of the first few several sutras together. So, in this practice, we may face some obstructions. This is natural. See, you find very often when we change our habits at the physical level, suppose you start doing things differently at the physical level, there may not be much of an obstruction. But when you try to change our habit at a mental level, then there are obstructions. We never become aware of these obstructions unless we really face them. So while discussing this, Patanjali says, there are five obstructions, of which three are essentially within the psychological analysis of Yoga Sutras. That is, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. These are the results. But the reason for it is our ego system, which is again because of our ignorance of our true nature. Well, about this true nature, I would say, how we interpret ourselves, how we look upon ourselves. If we look upon ourselves as a psychophysical mechanism, then avidya. Avidya here is only a function of chittam. It is, maybe some of you may remember later, avidya is an important subject of study in Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, but that's not what we are discussing here. In yoga tradition, avidya means is a function of chittam, our ignorance of our true nature, or rather our wrong definition of our own personality just as a psychophysical mechanism. This is avidya or ignorance. So ignorance is the translation, which may not fully become obvious in all its implications. Avidya means our wrong understanding as to what we essentially are, which is related to how we define our own purpose of life, goals of life, what life is meant for. So if you interpret yourself to be just a psychophysical mechanism, just a body-mind complex, then ego, individuality will come. That is, these are two, this one part of the sutra. The other part is more important from a psychological standpoint, that is raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. Three terms are used in Sanskrit. Raga means extreme attachment to certain things. That's the main problem. You find greed, a desire to possess things, even when we know they are not necessary for us, they can be troublesome. Still, the mind going after things, even after knowing fully well that we do not need them, and a desire for possessing those things can land us in trouble. That is extreme attachment, infatuation, extreme liking for certain things. Now, it is only one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is extreme aversion. So every kind of extreme feeling is the opposite of its opposite. This one side of the coin. So a person who is suffering from extreme infatuation, extreme attachment to the point of being enslaved, you can find that happening in our life. Even after reading scriptures, maybe after getting good education, association with good people, we may get some intellectual idea, conviction, it's not good for us. We should get out of this. It's a trap, psychological trap, mental trap. Still, our mind doesn't allow us to get out of this trap. It is called raga. And the same feeling functions in the opposite direction. It is called dvesha, extreme aversion towards things without any rational basis. So, and the third one is abhinivesha. So, if extreme attachment or extreme infatuation is moving towards something and extreme aversion is moving against certain things, then there is something else moving away from certain things. It is called abhinivesha. These are three important obstructions in spiritual life. We can see if you want to read a good book, if you want to pray, if you want to meditate, even if you want to change the course of our life, want to change a habit which we know to be bad, to be harmful, to be suicidal, but cannot get out of it. It could be in the form of aversion, it could be in the form of extreme attachment, kind of bondage, being bound by certain things. Now, these are obstructions in spiritual life. Now, how do we get out of these obstructions? These obstructions really function in the form of vrittis. That's another subject we discuss in this subject. What is vritti? This is discussed in Samadhipada also, but it is related to this. So how do these extreme infatuation, And extreme aversion, how do they function? They are related to vrittis, vasana, samskara. These are Sanskrit terms which I try to explain. So whatever actions we do, whatever thoughts we think, whatever words we speak, even an idea that flashes in the mind, will register some effect on the mental system. That effect is called a residual effect, is called vritti in yoga literature. It is translated as waves. It's just like, you know, if you throw a stone on the surface of water, it creates a disturbance in the waves. So maybe from that it has been translated wave. So vritti is the natural after effect of any kind of activity, physical, mental, intellectual. Now, the same kind of actions produce identical vrittis, identical effects, registers identical side effects. It becomes a tendency, it becomes what you call a samskara. And these samskaras is a very important word in Vedanta and also in yoga. Samskara means there are certain ways in which we behave that we are used to behaving in a particular manner. That's because we have been behaving in that manner sometime in the past. So you may call it habit. But habit only, the word habit touches only the surface of what actually it is. So we have one particular way of behaving, tendencies, impressions, which we cannot get out of. Our personality itself is constituted by these tendencies, impressions, etc. So that prompts us to do certain things in a certain manner. So every action produces a vritti, it produces a samskara, that again results in identical activities. We are all doing things, thinking, speaking, the way we have been trained to speak and think and act, because they have produced samskaras, natural tendencies, which are very strong. So these vrittis are responsible for that. So in this context, the Yoga Sutra, Patanjali himself doesn't do that. Patanjali's commentator, Vyasa, tries to analyze the state of human mind on the basis of natural tendencies. So he divides the human mind according to the way it remains, it functions. The five stages are, you know, moodham, kshiptam, moodham, vikshiptam, egagram, niruddham. So kshiptam, moodham, vikshiptam, egagram, niruddham. These are five stages. I shall try to explain. It becomes very simple because we all go through these stages of thoughts and ideas and tendencies every day. The first two stages deal with, rather they refer to a kind of some sort of an abnormal state of mind. We are not going to discuss in detail. One is kshiptam and moodham, or moodham we call. Kshiptam means this kind of restlessness because you cannot concentrate. Vimudham means the same ignorance or restlessness creates the mind more on like condition where you cannot act. The two states of abnormal mental system that's not elaborately discussed in the Yoga Sutra. The third, fourth and fifth stages are important. Vikshiptam is the third stage. And that's very natural. It's a common life experience for most of the ordinary spiritual seekers. We may feel that tomorrow we may decide. Or when we listen to a great lecture, great music, or great drama, watching a great drama, reading a great book, attending a prayer, trying to meditate, very often you find a great excitement, very wonderful. If you decide to come again tomorrow, to the same temple or any place of worship or anywhere, or to the same library to continue reading the same wonderful book that we admire, or meeting the same person, continuing the same discussion, anything that uplifts the mind, that gives a kind of serenity, happiness, mind. We want to do that, but mind does not allow that. So you can experiment with your own mind. Let us say tomorrow you take a decision today. Tomorrow 7 o'clock I shall pray. Take a decision. At 7 o'clock, if you have done a lot of prayers, then it becomes natural. Otherwise, at the 7 o'clock, you will be looking for an excuse for not doing that. It could be different kinds of, a part of the mind detaches itself from the main body of its structure and revolts against your attempt to meditate or pray. So after, for some time you get excited, get late peace of mind, serenity. After some time mind goes down. So it is compared to the pendulum of a clock, moving one direction, then the other direction. So this is natural for every ordinary spiritual seeker. One of the greatest contributions of Vyasa, who wrote a commentary on Patanjali Yoga Sutras, is this analysis of stage of human mind. Now modern psychology also will tell you this much. It tells you why this happens and how to get back, how to correct this problem. Modern psychology cannot tell you. That's Vyasa's contribution. So the third stage, Vikshiptam, is natural. Now how to make the mind, force the mind to cooperate with what you want to do, what you want to do and what you end up doing. Rather, what you really want to do, then a desire. Well, tomorrow I want to pray, but at the time, when the time comes, suddenly we become reluctant, or we find some excuse for not doing that. Somebody, something else in our mental system tries to turn us away from that. Even if we are convinced of the importance of prayer or reading a book, mind doesn't permit you to do that. At the physical level, we have a lot of autonomy. We can very often do what we want to do at the physical level. But at the mental level, mind doesn't give you much freedom. Mind doesn't permit you to do what you want to do. Now, if you force the mind to cooperate with you, it creates conflicts. So you can see people trying to meditate. Suddenly, you know, I've seen some people trying to meditate. They sit straight with the bulging muscles. A lot of strain, a lot of effort, a lot of labor. It's highly labored effort to sit straight and meditate. There's a grim expression on the face. This time I shall crush you. That kind of expression. That is exactly the opposite of the expression of a meditative person, a person who meditates. So actually he's fighting with his own mind. You can see this happening. In yoga studios you can find. People actually, you know, Patanjali's own definition of meditative posture called asana. Meditative posture is called asana. It is sthira sukham asana. You should be steady for a long time. You should be able to meditate. Sukha means it should be a very pleasant experience. If it is a very unpleasant experience, it means that's not for you and you are not for that, really speaking. So one important sign that our mind is ready to meditate is meditation becomes a natural, pleasant experience. There are people who try to smile. They're not in that kind of, you know, people laughing meditation, walking meditation, dancing meditation. I'm not talking about that. But then you say, sitting quiet and calming the mind trying to transcend its own problems, its own conflict, its own internal blocks. Well, it should be sukham. Sukham means, saukhya is the word in Sanskrit, it means a state in which you enjoy meditation. And then when you enjoy, you should be able to sit in that posture for a long time without being disturbed. That's why in when describing abhyasa and vairagya, Patanjali says, dirghakara nairandirya satkara asayavidu dhudabhumi. It's a very interesting sutra in the yoga sutras. Dirghakala means long time. You should be able to practice for a long time. Nairandirya means without any break, constant succession, without a break. Satkara asayavidu dhudabhumi means you should have a sense of sanctity, you should honor. Whatever you are doing, you should approach that meditation, abhyasa, vairagya, all these you should approach with the sense of honor, respect, sacredness, sanctity. When we do that, we can do it for a long time, we can do it without any break, and you will enjoy doing that without any effort. So, when this happens, mind is ready for meditation. But frequently, even though this is a very wonderful experience, unless you get a little bit of that, you won't be able to decide on whether you should do it or not. When you try to do, mental block comes. Now, Vyasa says, there is a way to change your mind. That's also a contribution of actually yoga psychology. You can change your mind, not just treating your mind, but changing the mind. What it says is, constant practice of self-restrained tapa and feeding the mind with spiritual food. You know, mind also needs food to keep it healthy. Otherwise, mind will fall sick. Just dirty water, if you drink, you become sick, your body becomes sick. So dirty food, the mind eats, it becomes sick. What is dirty food for mind? Wrong ideas, disturbing ideas. So you should go on feeding nourishing food to the mind. And nourishing food to the mind is good ideas. Reading, listening to, associating with people, from whom you can get this constant supply of nourishing food for the mind, ideas. So, with a great insight, Patanjali says, if you practice this, so self-restraint and feeding the mind with good food through good associations and a kind of surrender, if you practice Kriya Yoga through this Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga, you can get rid of these mental obstructions. Mental obstructions that keep the mind in a state of conflict, vikshipta mana. And then the mind develops the ability to concentrate. So, at a later stage, Patanjali says, this may be easy when you make a statement about it. But in actual life situation, it could be different. You know, in your workplace, in the university, in the hospital, in the family, in society, you have to move with people who may not be a constant suppliers of good mental food. Some of them supply poisonous food, newspapers, thriller novels, you know, create some. There are very bad ideas, lot of poisonous mental food available in newspapers, in the internet, in social media, everywhere. So how to approach them? That is also one of the uniqueness of Patanjali system. So he recommends a way of dealing with the external world. How to deal with different types of persons, individuals whom you meet in different life situations. Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, Ubeksha. That's what he says. How to attain Chitta Prasada? I mean, how to develop this serenity of mind? So, he says, four approaches, Maitri, Karuna, Mudita and Ubeksha. Actually, this may be a Sanskrit word, so you may think something very complicated, very simple matter. When you find people, let's say, spiritual seekers like ourselves, who may be also interested in spiritual life, who may be struggling to progress, be friendly with them. So, that means association with other spiritual seekers is a great help in spiritual life. So, if you read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find Sri Ramakrishna, one of his recommendations, you know, whenever some youngsters came to meet him, some people, devotees came to meet him, Sri Ramakrishna would say, a saint is living there, good devotee, go and meet him. Where are you coming from? You said from that particular part of the city. Oh, there is a wonderful devotee, you go and meet him. So Sri Ramakrishna wanted all good people to meet each other. Why? Because when you meet people of your own temperament, you are also spiritual seekers, then your spiritual food, for the spiritual food your mind is supplied. And then there are some other people who may not be as advanced as ourselves, but interested in spiritual life. You should be compassionate. You should not look down upon those who want to know certain things but didn't have the good fortune to read good books or to be associated with spiritual persons. You should be sympathetic, karuna. Third quality is mudita. Then in the process you may come across some very wonderful people who are spiritually advanced, more advanced than ourselves. So we should be able to enjoy, to celebrate the greatness of others. So mudita actually means being happy. Those who are spiritually more advanced than ourselves, or those who are good people but are more highly evolved than ourselves, you should not be jealous of them. You see, when you admire somebody for some good quality, that quality comes to you. And when you become jealous of somebody for a good quality, whatever of that quality you have got, that will be lost. This psychological phenomenon. So what we admire in others, that we get, automatically your mind will be trying to evolve those very qualities for which we admire certain persons. So when we admire a person for his spiritual, for the spirituality, wisdom, then that's the best way to develop that wisdom within ourselves. What you admire and recognize and appreciate in others, that comes to you. What you refuse to appreciate in others out of jealousy, whatever you have got it, you'll be lost. That's an interesting thing. In human life you can find children who admire great footballers. This, I mean, soccer or but this football, whatever it may be. You know, they eventually try to practice it. At least they will do a little bit of practice, they may try to become footballers. Those who admire great musicians may have a tendency, a skill, an aptitude for music, and they may become great musicians. Those who admire others for artistic abilities, they may become artists themselves. So what we admire in others, that we develop in our own character. The fourth category, well, that is the sellers of poisonous food for mind. There are people, if you associate with them, you will get a whole bunch of negative ideas. Negative ideas, so you have some strong good conviction which you try to follow, which gives you a sense of relevance and meaningfulness in life. So you are interested in mysticism, art, poetry, literature, or philosophy, yoga, Vedanta, whatever it is. Somebody You have to constantly live with a person who tell you these are all absolute rubbish. Don't go for your gibberish. If you constantly associate with people who criticize these great things, which you admire, you know, slowly there's a chance that your conviction, your own appreciation may be affected if you're a beginner. If you're more advanced, you may think he's a crazy fellow, you don't care for him. But if you're a beginner, it's always a chance that we may be converted to their side. So, Patanjali says, upeksha means indifference. So, we should develop a mental filtering mechanism. And that's very important. This common sense wisdom, which Patanjali makes it a great idea that is helpful in spiritual life. There are people with wrong ideas, ideas that we know will be harmful to us. Ideas that could shake our own convictions, take us away from our own chosen path, and will create a lot of chaos, disturbance in our mental system. So, but we have to live with them. You have to work in a workplace. Everywhere you may not find all great saints talking to you about spiritual things. It's not an easy thing to imagine. The possibility is rather remote. So what you should do, Patanjali says, and if Patanjali says Vyasa in his commentary, develop a mental filtering mechanism. That is, keep away from those people. You cannot physically keep away. You may be your boss, perhaps, you know, in the workplace. But you may be listening, you may have to hear those things, but mentally we must keep ourselves away from them without those words influencing our mind. That's the idea. So the whole process is Patanjali yoga system will give you a framework, a training for higher evolution in life, in spiritual life, in cultural life, in intellectual life. So we'll have interactions. You can ask questions from any part of the yoga forums, because we are, this is a kind of recapitulation. We are taking stock of what we have been discussing so far. Okay. You can ask questions. Yeah. Enjoyment here means prasada, chitta prasada. Prasada is not just enjoyment, but enjoyment is an important part of it, ingredient. I mean, you feel a kind of inner serenity, inner fulfillment, completeness, and joy. So, it is, there's a deeper identification with the essence of it. So, enjoyment is one word that we can use from ordinary language, but it's in its grosser level, it means something much less, you know. So here it means you feel a kind of inner completeness, inner fulfillment, inner contentment, serenity when you evolve. That's called chitta prasada. That's one word. But another context where it comes, another word is used, sukha. That is in the context of asana postures. So, Patanjali uses only one aphorism out of 195 to define posture, physical posture, asanas, sthira sukham asanam. So, if you read the mythological books, or if you read the Gheranda Samhita, Hatha Yoga Pratipika, Shiva Samhita, there are quite a few texts, 4 or 5 important texts on Hatha Yoga, physical yoga. There are mythological teachers who tell you there are some tens of thousands of yoga postures. It's a mythological way of putting it. The whole process, all asanas are just help, meant to help you to be able to sit for a long time with a sense of sukha, The sukha here means ayatna lalita sukha. Ayatna means effortlessness and spontaneity, naturalness. That is what is called sukha in the yoga tradition, in the posture tradition. Means if you sit, you should not be aware of the body. Body should not remind you of its own existence. That's a real proof that you are physically healthy. If body reminds you, well, I'm here, it may be reminding you with a headache, stomach pain, or some illness, which means it is unhealthy. So a body which is perfectly healthy will help you to transcend itself. So that state is called, that state is characterized by this feeling of effortlessness and spontaneous enjoyment. Let's see, that is a sukha in the definition of yoga asana, is it called asana? Well, it's one of the Ashtanga yogas in the Samadhi Pada. Ashtanga yoga described in Sadhana Pada, of course, Sadhana Pada. Yeah.
Here's a question, it may be very simple.
Yeah.
What is the yogic or Vedantic definition of a human being? Of a human being.
Definition of a human being. Vedanta and yoga differ in this matter. That's why we are going to Vedanta after this. See, yoga is only a help, a science that helps you to develop a serene, peaceful mind by removing all its impurities. So that is why in the invocation, yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya vaidyakena yopakurottam pravaram muninam padanjalim pranjali dhanatosmi. Padanjali's purpose behind writing this Yoga Sutra is to remove, to completely eradicate all the impurities of mind, so that mind becomes serene through chitta virti nirodha. Okay, after that, next, that is Vedanta comes. So great teachers like Shankaracharya explains Vedanta as a great tool, as a great preparatory stage for you to reach mental fitness to practice Vedanta. It's an elaborate science. So Yoga Sutra is an elaborate study of human mind, intelligence, thoughts, emotions, feelings, senses, and whole operation. That's why people are drawn towards this, because it takes you where you stand. So the higher Vedanta becomes very relevant, and the meaningfulness of going beyond yoga and study Vedanta becomes naturally evident when you study Yoga Sutras. That's why in the Gita itself is called, Yoga Shastra. Yoga Shastra, the Gita, yoga is elevated to higher level. Whole philosophy of life becomes yoga. For that higher level, one should know how our mind functions. For example, how to restrain the mind from eating poisonous food, as we mentioned here. It's very important. How to, let's say, for example, students studying in schools, for example, if they are exposed to good intellectual food, that's needed. So the students come from world religions class. They come from school, so they are very happy because they are in a different place. This atmosphere, this temple, and all that is very fascinating for these children, students, most school students, 12th grade and all that. They are very happy, but they are given only 45 minutes. They want more, but the teachers, they will blow the whistle, and they have to get back. So I've seen, it's interesting how these students are interested in knowing these things. Maybe for them it's just a curiosity, but you all begin at the curiosity level. Suppose we expose these ideas to these students, or expose the students to these ideas. That's one way of actually helping them to have access to healthy mental food. That's the idea. Because the moment you go to internet, you open newspapers and magazines, you get poisonous food. Well, it's not a criticism, I'm not criticizing media or anything. Frequently, unfortunately, it so happens, there are wonderful things in newspapers and media. There are many wonderful, useful things, no doubt about it. But unfortunately, very often, a lot of problems arise because students do not get enough access to healthy ideas, creative ideas, constructive ideas. Ideas that go beyond getting a degree, getting a job, making money. That's why. That's why Patanjali see the importance of swadhyaya, means feeding the mind with good food. So, these ideas are very relevant. Okay. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.